Okay, what we're going to do first is review some of the general concepts of finance. In fact, I'll label these general concepts of finance. And you can see what I'm doing here is I'm using an electronic pen. This thing gets a bit sensitive every once in a while, so bear with me. I will at times have to back up and erase things to make them correct. And all I'm going to do in this particular review is go through and I think 1 through 4 highlight the general concepts that you should have gotten from chapter 1. First of all, I guess what we should do is identify or define what finance is all about. And we discussed this before, but finance really deals with money. And it deals with decisions about money. More importantly, what we'll find out as we go through the remainder of the course is that we're talking about value. All the decisions that we make in finance are based on value. For example, if I'm going to buy a stock, I want to know the value of the stock and whether it is a good value. If it's a good value, I'll invest in it. If the value is too high or what I think is too high, then I won't invest in that stock. Now, there's three items or factors that make up value or determine value. First of all, cash flows. When we talk about value, we're talking about the future cash flows that a particular investment will generate. If you invest money today and you don't expect to get anything back in the future, that's a worthless investment. There's no value to it. If you expect to get cash flows, even if it's just one cash flow in the future, then your investment has value. Okay, second factor that goes into value is what we call the rate, or the interest rate, or the rate of return. The rate of return is very important because it determines the overall value of whatever the investment happens to be. And the rate of return is determined by the markets, as we'll find out later on. But this rate is the opportunity cost, or what the investor earns by investing in the investment. The higher that rate, then the lower the amount that the person needs to invest today to get to the same amount in the future. The third factor that is important is timing. And this is the timing of the cash flows. Think about if an investment that would pay $100,000. Now, $100,000 to be received in 1 year is different than $100,000 to be received in 10 years. It's more valuable if you get it in 1 year than if you get it in 10 years. What about if you get it in 1,000 years? It's certainly not worth as much today as it would be if you got it 1 year from today. So as I mentioned, we'll talk more about value as we get through the course. The second area that we'll talk about from this, the general concepts of Chapter 1, are the different forms of business. Now, there's three basic or primary forms of business. And those are, let me go ahead and write all three of them down here. Those are proprietorship. I would describe them as we go. Proprietorship is a business that is owned by one person. In other words, there is one owner. Very simple to set up. Really all you have to do is get whatever the local licenses to be in business are. Then there's a partnership, which actually is the same as a proprietorship, except that there are multiple owners. So there has to be at least two owners. And there's no limit on the maximum number of owners, but there has to be at least two. Now, one of the limitations or disadvantages to both of these, proprietorship and partnership, is that the owners have unlimited liability for the debts of the firm. And actually, it's unlimited personal liability for the debts of the firm. What that means is very simple, that if the firm gets in debt, it's basically the same as the owners getting in debt. So if the firm gets in debt and goes out of business, let's say, and the firm owes $250,000 after selling all the assets and settling with as many of the creditors as possible, then the owners are going to have to make up that difference by selling. Maybe one owner has two or three houses. That owner is going to have to sell one or two of those houses to make up the $250,000. So they're going to have to liquidate their personal assets to make up the debt that was incurred by the business. The third primary form of business is a corporation. Now remember, a corporation is it's a legal entity. It's a separate type of business. And the advantage here, first of all, the evidence of ownership is stock. So if you own stock in a company, you're the owner of that company. The big advantage to ownership, owning a corporation, is that there is limited liability. And the limited liability, the liability of the owners is limited to the amount that is invested in the stock of the company. So if I own IBM stock, for example, and I invested $10,000 in IBM stock, and IBM went out of business and owed billions of dollars after liquidating all of its assets and paying as much of the liabilities or as many of the creditors as possible, then I'm not going to lose any more money. I'll lose the $10,000 I invested, and the creditors cannot come after me to make me liquidate any of my personal assets. Now, if I buy stock in a company and I don't run that company, well, first of all, if I buy stock in that company, one of the things I want to happen is that I want to follow a particular goal. And that goal, the overall goal I want to be followed, is to maximize value. And the reason why I want the company to follow this goal is because maximizing value increases the stock price. And I'll even put that out here. I'll put it equals the stock price. Because the price of the stock goes up, I am wealthier because I own stock in that particular company. Now, one of the things that I do when I own a very large company that has quite a few owners is I'm not the person who makes the day-to-day decisions. For example, if I own Dell Computers, it's Michael Dell. He's the CEO of Dell Computers, and he and his top management run the company on a daily basis, so they make the daily decisions. Well, what I really do is when I buy the company, I effectively, I do this implicitly, I guess I should say, is assign the top management, the decision makers, as my agents. And what that means is I'm basically implicitly telling them to do the right thing. And doing the right thing means to maximize the value of the firm. If those decision makers decide that they want to make decisions that are in their best interest, in other words, the decision makers' best interest, but they harm me, the owner, and all the other owners of the firm, then we have what we call an agency problem, because the agents of the firm are not operating according to the best interests of the owners. An agency problem does exist when the decision makers are making decisions that are in their best interest, but they harm or are not in the best interest of most of the owners of the firm. There's ways we can get the management to make the correct decisions. We can reward them for doing so. In other words, we can tie their compensation to maximizing the value of the firm. If we don't like the way the firm is being managed, we the shareholders, the owners, can intervene. We can go to the annual meeting and we can vote out the board of directors who favor those particular managers and vote in a new board of directors. And in that case, the new board of directors would fire the existing decision makers and hire new ones. If the managers aren't making the right decisions, the firm's value isn't maximized, then it's what we call an undervalued firm. In other words, its value isn't the best it can be. Undervalued firms can be, they're prime targets for takeovers. There's firms all over the world looking for good firms that are operating inefficiently, and they want to take them over. And usually when that happens, the first people to go, top management, because it's top management that got the firm in that particular position. Let's get back to this thing, this goal of maximizing value. This should be the primary goal of the firm. So let me even put it out here, primary goal. This goal, if the firm does the right thing and maximizes value, then this is a good goal to achieve. Because maximizing value means you got to keep the customers happy, you got to keep employees happy, the government has to be happy with you, the local community, and especially the owners have to be happy. So when we maximize value, we actually increase the standard of living of the area, the United States, if all firms do that. So this is a great goal to have. One goal that a lot of people think that a firm should pursue, let me get my pen down here, is to maximize, and I'm going to abbreviate over here to the right, maximize income. You hear that over and over again. Well, maximizing, I'll circle this thing, maximizing income is a short-term goal, whereas maximizing value is a long-term goal. Maximizing value means we're looking to the future, looking for the firm to stay in business forever, if you will. Maximizing income can actually put the firm out of business. So at this point, I'll go ahead, I'm going to leave it on the screen here, but I'm going to go ahead and cross out, let me use a different color here, I'm going to go ahead and delete or cross out the goal of maximizing income, because it's not a goal that we should pursue. Now let me give you an example of how we can maximize income and actually go out of business. Let's say a firm has old machinery, fully depreciated. So there is no depreciation expense on the income statement. That means the bottom line net income is pretty good. If the firm wants to maximize income next year, then it should not buy new equipment. It should keep the existing equipment because depreciation expense is zero. If it buys new equipment, then it's going to have a depreciation expense, and if everything else is equal, in other words, the revenues are the same and other expenses are the same, income is going to be lower next year because of the increased depreciation expense. So if the firm wants to maximize its income, why not just keep using the same machinery until it dies? Well, one of the problems with that is when that machinery dies, perhaps the firm has to shut down for a few months. And if the firm is in that case, that would be to go out and purchase new machinery and get it on board and all that stuff. If this particular company is in a very competitive industry, customers are going to go to the competitors. When the firm reopens, chances are those customers will not come back. So the firm's going to find it doesn't have any business or it doesn't have as much business as it did before it had to shut down. And in that case, it might have to go out of business in a year or two. So you can see how maximizing income might actually put the firm out of business. All right, let's finish this summary up or this review up by looking at international finance. International finance deals with multinational corporations and the different decisions that they make. First of all, pretty much all the concepts that we use in domestic finance or making decisions about finance or financial decisions in the United States, they're the same concepts we use all over the world. Now we're going to see this throughout the course in different chapters and so forth. But think about this. Pretty much everything is global nowadays. Corporations go international for a variety of reasons. You can look them up, but some of them are to get to new markets, get new customers. You saturate the market in the United States, why not go to China or India or some other country? Some businesses go to other countries to get raw materials. I mean, think about Singapore, small island country, has no natural resources. Those have to be imported from other countries. And there's a variety of other reasons, like getting around political and regulatory hurdles and so forth. One of the things that we've got to be careful with in terms of going international is not going overseas and imposing the American way on foreign countries. You got to realize that when you go overseas, you're going to deal in different denominations of currency. Not everybody deals in the U.S. dollar. Languages are different. Unfortunately, those of you who grew up in the United States and were schooled in the United States, you know English, but probably know other languages, whereas international students know 2, 3, 4, even 5 languages, one of which is English. So Americans typically are at a disadvantage when they go global. But there's cultural differences, things that that are natural or normal in the United States might be illegal or frowned upon in foreign countries. And, you know, government's intervention are different in different countries. In the United States, the government doesn't really... Actually, our government tries to stay out of business as much as possible, whereas in other countries, government is very heavily involved in business, either supporting the domestic business, taking money and taxing the domestic businesses, and so forth. So we really need these factors really come into play when firms or businesses go international. So if you're going to open an international business, please do your homework. Make sure you're aware of all the factors that are involved.